Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashley Wehner. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Ghassan K. Abu Alpha, MD, an attending physician at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, New York. Dr. Abu Alpha joined us to speak about the FDA approval of durvalumab plus tremelimumab in hepatocellular carcinoma. On October 24, 2022, the FDA approved the combination of durvalumab and tremelimumab for adult patients with unresectable hepatocellular carcinoma. The regulatory decision was supported by the results of the Phase 3 Himalaya trial, in which the STRIDE regimen elicited an overall survival of 16.43 months versus 13.77 months with sorafenib. The 3-year overall survival rates were 30.7% with the combination versus 20.2% with sorafenib. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Abu Alpha discussed the significance of this approval, the STRIDE regimen's unique mechanism of action, and the importance of expanding access to this combination for patients around the world. Thank you so much again for taking the time to speak with me today. So just to start off, could you discuss the significance of this approval?
Thank you very much for having me. It's a great delight to see about an approval of the combination of two dual checkpoint inhibitors, tremelimumab plus durvalumab, for patients with advanced liver cancer and the need for stem therapy. So this is a great add-on of therapy that we're very delighted for, especially that probably it's the easiest to manage from the patient perspective, which is very important. The tremelimumab is given only once, and the durvalumab is given only as an IV once a month. So you can imagine out of nowhere, patients now are living and they're having great control of their schedule and not necessarily going back and forth for therapy or taking pills of any kind. It's one dose for the first drug, tremelimumab, and durvalumab is given once every month.
Could you discuss the mechanism of action of this combination?
Admittedly, none or many of us are not necessarily the kind of experts in regard to immunotherapy. And it's very important for us to understand, however, what's going on. And it's also important to relate to our patients what exactly is going on over here. The concept is dependent on the PD-1, PD-L1, which are always, I think, of as being like nice chairs offered by the cancer at the cell membrane level to kind of like offer some way for the T cells coming from our lymph nodes to sit down, relax, and don't touch the cancer. So this way, you know what? Don't bug me, I don't bug you kind of thing. Interestingly, all what anti-PD-1 like durvalumab as an anti-PD-L1 will do, kick that chair out. So now the T cells will jump onto the cancer or fall onto the cancer and attack it and try to act on it as a foreign body, same like we attack bacteria, viruses, what have we. Interestingly, we have learned that this action to happen, it needs a phone call from upstairs in the chain of command. And that chain of command starts, of course, at the lymph node itself. This is where CTLA-4 comes into play. Because in general, CD28 will talk to two other friends called CD80 and CD86. And they kind of like, how to say, drink very strong coffee altogether. And now CD86 send that message all the way to the chair to be kicked out by the anti-PD-L1. Well, guess what? CTLA-4 come into play, you know, convince CD86 to hang around together. They drink God knows what, some alcohol or whatever. They all fall asleep. Nothing happens. So as such, as much as you give durvalumab, if you don't really trigger that action up there, nothing's going to happen. So this is interestingly where an anti-CTLA-4 like tremelimumab will come into play, take away CTLA-4, permit CD86 to do their job and send the message to the anti-PD-L1 durvalumab down there. So interestingly, and this is a key element, that anti-CTLA-4 of tremelimumab is so powerful and so potent enough that even it's 3 times more potent than CD28 in the natural phenomenon in us, enough that's why you give the dose only once. And by the way, all that simplistic way of how I described it, this is what the Nobel Prize for 2019 in medicine was.
Could you elaborate on how this agent supports some unmet needs in this patient population?
The concept of unmet needs still depends on a very important variable, which is what we all aspire for, cure. And as such, as long as we are still away from cure, we have an unmet need. And as such, even though it's a great outcome in the positive direction, we have now a longer survival. Remember, now the survival of the patient is like close to 16 and a half months as a median. And also based on the durvalumab plus tremelimumab, based on the Himalaya study that we're talking about today, one third of the patients were alive at 3 years. This is great stuff, but still, however, we need to do more. So definitely it does fulfill a certain component of the unmet need, but yes, there's still more to do.
So then what key efficacy data were seen in the Himalaya trial? And were any of these findings particularly notable or surprising to you?
So the study, again, for the Himalaya, or the combination of the durvalumab plus tremelimumab, which now we call the STRIDE regimen, showed an improvement in outcome. And the median survival, as we all know, was 16.43 months compared to the sorafenib 13.77 months. And this was clinically and statistically significant. Interestingly, as we all know now, as much as we provided the right answers from this study and great positive answers, of course, we got a lot of other explanations as well. Now we know that the priming of the T cells to prime them up to be ready to fight the cancer takes a while. And as such, the median is not necessarily really the focus that we should really be kind of, you know, concentrated on, because as time goes and as much as there's more T cells kind of fighting the cancers, we're going to see continued separation of the curves, enough that will be diverted by about the 30% median survival at the 3 years compared to the sorafenib. And this is where we kind of like continue to use, and here the tails of the curve are too long in checkpoint inhibitors. Well, guess what? They are too long, because as always I say, the median survival, yes, it's positive, but at the same time, the median survival is not the only story. We're kind of like almost like reading a new language about the priming and the activity of the checkpoint inhibitors, but we're using an old dictionary, which is the one we use for stoichiometric chemotherapy interventions per se. That's a very important teaching point in that regard. That's important not to forget at all. And the other one is progression-free survival, because of that priming that I just spoke about, might not differ much. And actually, you can say almost like, so what? Because really, it's all, after all, about survival. And because that kind of response will take a while until it's primed up, it might be missed by the PFS, but does not mean that we don't have a positive results, as we have shown in the Himalaya study.
What common toxicities are important to mention with this combination?
So no question that the combination of the tremelimumab and durvalumab across the board has been rather well tolerated. Understandably, all therapies will cause certain adverse events, but thankfully we did not necessarily have like any serious concern that really rose out of nowhere as like, wait a minute, what are we dealing with here? Because if anything, the grade 3 and 4 toxicity with the combination were really limited to very, very subtle. Like, you know, we're talking about like 4% for diarrhea. And at the same time, we're talking about like 5% elevated liver function tests. And at the same time, probably a little bit less of increase in certain numbers. For example, the MLA is 3.6%, and, you know, maybe like 6%. But still, these are like very subtle numbers, less than 10% per se. So there's a lot of kind of, you know, margin of tolerance for the therapy. And the classic adverse events that we can see with checkpoint inhibitors, like, for example, joint pains, or for example, rashes or diarrhea, they occur, of course, but not to the extent that we would like them to be.
How do you see this combination fitting into the current treatment paradigm for this population?
This is a very important point. 20 years ago, there was really barely any choice of therapy. And then we got one treatment, and now we have many treatment choices. And it's very important to recognize two important things. Number one, this is great news for the patients. There's a lot of options. There's a lot of therapies. By all means, this is great. We're happy to see that. On the other hand, though, the comparison and kind of like decision-making should be a very thought-of mechanism, and not simply, oh, I like that because it's higher numbers or lower numbers or what have we. So great choices for sure. And we're going to concentrate on the first-line therapies. At the moment, we have literally 4 choices of first-line therapies. We have the tyrosine kinase inhibitors being sorafenib. We have also tyrosine kinase inhibitor being lenvatinib. And then we have, of course, the great combination of atezolizumab plus bevacizumab as a checkpoint inhibitor plus anti-VEGF. And of course, we have durvalumab plus tremelimumab, which is the subject that we are discussing with today. If I were to do any comparative work, and to be fair, the comparisons were done only in some of them part of clinical trials. Number one, sorafenib and lenvatinib, the median survival is the same based on the reflex study, which was a non-inferiority study. But at the same time, clearly we know very clearly because of the kinome of the lenvatinib that is a way more potent drug, and clearly it can have a critical improvement in regard to progression-free survival and response rates. When it comes to the checkpoint inhibitor plus combination, we know very well that both the combinations that I mentioned, being atezolizumab plus bevacizumab and durvalumab, tremelimumab, are definitely way better than the single agent tyrosine kinase inhibitors. The question is, however, how to pick and choose between the two. To be fair, it becomes a decision making that's really based on data, not on direct comparison, because the direct comparison never happened. What are the components that really can be analytical or be thought of in that regard? Number one, as we all know, want to make sure that people have been response to therapy and benefit from it. The important component here is when we compare data of different clinical trials, and we all do it, even though we say we should not do it, but we all do it, but we have to look into the demographics of the populations. On one hand, in the atezolizumab plus bevacizumab, about 50% of patients were hepatitis B. Interestingly, in the Himalaya study of the durvalumab, tremelimumab, only about 30% were hepatitis B. What's more fascinating is that there has been data from the real world data coming from a study in the UK called the Real AB study that was recently reported at the ELCA meeting in Madrid in Spain back in September. And it showed, interestingly, that the mean survival for the atezolizumab plus bevacizumab is not 19, it's 15 point something months. How come? Because to be fair, they saw there's actually in the real world way less patients with hepatitis B than it was on the study itself. So we have to really look very carefully about who is who in those populations. And as such, you might say convenience, maybe a certain improvement within the same context of the patient population. Yeah, maybe could be an intriguing point, but bottom line, bring in other variables, among which a very important one, the nice thing about the durvalumab, tremelimumab is very straightforward to give. With the atezolizumab plus bevacizumab, you have to scope the patients. Endoscopy is very critical because they need to look if there are varices or not, because bevacizumab, giving it for patients with varices, people can bleed and they can die. And by all means, the element here is make sure any of us who are still convinced that they give atezolizumab plus bevacizumab, please, please, we urge you, make sure that the patient get the endoscopy. On the other hand, the inconvenience of the endoscopy might be a little bit of a challenge for the patient. They might decide accordingly otherwise. A third one is important is in regard to the potential of immune reaction to the checkpoint inhibitors, which we'll know very well about, which is called the anti-drug antibodies. It's like the same story as like a child goes for the first time to kindergarten and they ask, is a child allergic to peanuts? I don't know. I never gave it to. And the same thing over here. We cannot tell in advance who can get an anti-drug antibody, in other words, antibody against the drug per se. But now we know that, interestingly, all of them can get anti-drug antibody, but the atezolizumab has extremely high potential for anti-drug antibody, 30%. Actually, it was reported in other literature, even 50%. But in the HCC study itself, in the AMBRAVE 150, to give credit to the investigator who did test it per se, 30%. While in the setting of durvalumab, it's only 1.5%. So you do the math and you can decide, because already the FDA put in the package insert of the atezolizumab that with anti-drug antibody, the value and the benefits from the drugs drops down. And number two, there has been data in JAMA Oncology talk about the comparison between the patients with anti-drug antibody versus no anti-drug antibody with atezolizumab, and it showed that there is less benefit for the patient with the anti-drug antibody. So it's very important to realize that we cannot check on that anti-drug antibody, but it's very important to at least consider that we have an obligation to tell the patients that, yes, you have a 30% chance you might not benefit from the therapy the way we would like to aspire for. So I think all those variables, I'm not necessarily giving one direction or the other over here, but at least it's very important to think about them and not to have a knee-jerk reaction. Okay, I'm going to go this because I saw a high number or what have we. We have to look very carefully and analytically be able to choose what's best for the patients.
How would you envision worldwide access to this therapy being created and developed in that way?
We are so delighted and we're very happy to see that we have new choice of therapy. And we are beyond thrilled that we have an improvement in patients' outcome based on that therapy. And not only that, but a very well-tolerated therapy that patients can live their life, as we mentioned in the beginning, one drug given only by IV once a month and one other drug given only once, and that's it. So people can live their life with this. Realistically and sadly, though, not everybody will probably have direct access to that therapy. And that's why it's our obligation, as delighted as we are, we have to work all hand in hand, being from the academic world, from the sponsors for all those efforts to make sure that we ultimately be able to deliver those therapies to every patient, wherever they are in the world. After all, realistically, and for example, it's an important fact, we proudly did this kind of analysis with our colleagues, for example, and throughout the whole continent of Africa. Still, 84% of the patients in Africa have only access to sorafenib, which is something that we already passed on very well in regard to the care for patients in the Western Hemisphere. So a lot of work to do there. Great start, but definitely we should not forget about making sure that we get access to everybody for that therapy.
The last question I have for you is if there is any ongoing research in this area at Memorial Sloan Kettering that you're excited about.
So, of course, we are very delighted with the FDA approval. Be assured, I definitely got a few minutes of celebration, but then we are back to work. Been there, done that. We're trying to enhance further, and we have a superb team in regard to being preclinical and clinical work to see how we can further improve on the outcome with the use of checkpoint inhibitors. But at the same time, we're definitely already in the second step of the therapy for liver cancer. Again, we remember, as we spoke in the beginning, also with the aim of cure. And for that reason, we continue in our efforts on the CAR-T program, and we look forward to hopefully report something one day.
Thank you so much for taking the time and for giving such comprehensive and eloquent answers to all of these questions. Congratulations on this approval. Very exciting stuff. So thank you for taking the time today.
Oh, thanks so much, Isling. Congratulations to our patients and delighted. They were great teamwork throughout the world. Very much big thanks, especially to all our dear colleagues who really made a critical contribution to that effort. Thank you.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.